As I said recently, in the last year, Palau, P-A-L-A-U, Nauru's N-A-U-R-U, and Tuvalu, T-U-V-A-L-U, they joined the other side. But apart from the United States, Israel, Federated States of Micronesia, Marshall Islands, Nauru, Tuvalu, and Palau, that's it. That's it. There's a compelling, we'll call a new expression, it's against broad. There's a compelling consensus supporting the two-state settlement, adamantly opposed by Israel, the United States, and its and whatever else, other countries. Okay, that's the as I said, there are areas of legitimate disagreement within the framework, which we shouldn't forget that there's a broad consensus for resolving the conflict, which the United States and Israel have steadfastly prevented from realizing its objective, namely to resolve the conflict peacefully and with justice to all sides. Now, there's a large body of disagreement and controversy about the Israel-Palestine conflict, which to my thinking is completely contrived. It's fabricated. Its purpose is to divert and to confuse people about what the real issues are in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And it's those fabricated sources of disagreement which I think account for most of the controversy and the disagreement surrounding the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I want to discuss three of those, to my thinking, the three major areas of contrived or fabricated disagreement about the Israel-Palestine conflict. Those kinds of disagreement, the aim and purpose of which is simply to divert attention from the real issues or to simply sow confusion about what are the real issues. One form of this fabricated disagreement is the effort to mystify the conflict, to envelop it in this ideological cloud, and to pretend that it simply can't be understood unless you have some grasp or the equivalent grasp of rocket science or particle physics. That this is a very difficult conflict to understand. It goes back, you usually hear things like it goes back to biblical enmities, ancient hatreds, or more recently, clashes of religion, clashes of civilization, that it can't be compared to any other conflict. The fancy word is the conflict, they use the Latin expression, it's sui generis, it can't be compared, or in a language we're more accustomed to, it's unique. Like the Nazi Holocaust is unique, and the Jewish people are unique, and the Jewish nation is unique. Anything involving the Jews is always unique. You can't compare. And so the Israel-Palestine conflict involves Jews, so you can't compare. It's unique. Well, the fact of the matter is, I don't think it's particularly complicated at all. And if people make the most ordinary sorts of analogies with reasonably comparable situations, it's perfectly clear what happened and what's happening now. Not difficult at all. Let's take the question of resistance. What accounts for the resistance of the Palestinians to, or resistance over the last 100 years to the Zionist and later the Israeli enterprise? Well, I was kind of surprised when I opened Benny Morris's book, his bigger volume called Righteous Victims. I'm reading the book, and at some point he writes, early on in the book, he writes as follows. The fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. The fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Now, some of you are wondering, well, what's such a big deal about that sentence? I could have written it. Yeah, it doesn't look particularly brilliant, profound, and yet when I read it, the words kind of leapt off the page for me. Why did they leap off the page? Well, notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say it was anti-Semitism that was the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. He doesn't say it's hatred of Jews or hatred of European civilization, or all of those other commonplaces we hear nowadays. His explanation is perfectly straightforward and perfectly uncomplicated, simple. They resisted Zionism because they feared, as it turned out, rightfully so, that if the Zionist movement succeeded in reaching and achieving its objectives, it would be at the expense of the indigenous population, that the indigenous population would be dispossessed and displaced. Not very complicated, perfectly analogous to, well, analogous to what happened in North America. Let's take an obvious example. Let's say you were to, somebody's writing a history book on Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment. And the resistance was very bloody. We shouldn't kid ourselves about that. The Native Americans, they killed men, women, children, infants. It was brutal. No question about that. We don't want to be politically correct. It was very brutal. It was brutal on the Euro-American side also, but we shouldn't be blinded to the fact it was also very brutal on the, what you call first, what's the expression you use, first peoples. It was very brutal on the Native American side. You know, someone like the former president and also historian Theodore Roosevelt, he writes in his book, it was a multi-volume history, The Winning of the West, he said sometimes, you know, the frontiersmen, they descended to the levels of savagery of the Native Americans. Yeah, well, it was more than sometimes. It was most of the time. But it was savage in all sides, and we shouldn't kid ourselves about that. Okay, it was brutal. But how would we react if we opened up a history book and a historian tried to explain the Native American resistance, often brutal, by saying that they were motivated by anti-Europeanism or anti-whiteism or anti-Christianism? Well, you would laugh. You don't need to conjure up profound cosmic explanations about why the Native Americans resisted. The answer is right there. It's staring you in the face. They resisted because they understood that they would, if the Euro-American enterprise succeeded, it would result in their, to now use Benny Morris's terms, their territorial displacement and dispossession. Not very complicated, I don't think. The second source, or fabricated source, of the conflict over the Israel-Palestine conflict, the fabricated disagreement, is playing the Holocaust card, the dragging in of the Nazi Holocaust to somehow provide justification or a rationale for what Israel is doing. That card only first began to be played, I should say, in the Western world. It only first began to be played after the June 1967 war. Israel, from early on, tried to play that card, but Israel was just a backwater before 1967, and nobody paid, you know, much attention to its efforts to kind of demonize the Palestinians and demonize all criticism of Israel as emanating from anti-Semitism and being equivalent to supporting the Holocaust. The Holocaust card, as I said, only first began to be played after the June 1967 war, and the main thrust of that effort was to insist on the uniqueness of the Nazi Holocaust, the uniqueness of the suffering that Jews endured during World War II, and the argument, the unstated but plainly intended argument, was that because Jews suffered uniquely during World War II, that they were entitled to unique moral dispensations now, that you can't hold Israel and Jews to the same moral standards as other people because they suffered uniquely during the Nazi Holocaust. There's a lot to be said on that topic. I'm not sure if now is the time to go into it, but it's important to keep in mind that it was sheer political manipulation of the Nazi Holocaust. There were Nazi Holocaust figured barely at all in American Jewish life before 1967, and it figured not at all in American life generally after 1967, before 67, for, you know, straightforward political reasons. After World War II, the United States enters into a major political alliance with West Germany, the pillar of American power in Europe. And West Germany was staffed, apart from some window dressing people like Konrad Adenauer, who was an anti-fascist, apart from people like Adenauer, the whole German government was staffed with ex-Nazis, you know, for obvious reasons. Germany was divided into two. If you were on the left, you went to East Germany. If you were on the right, you stayed in West Germany. And so the whole West German bureaucracy and the legal profession and medical profession was all ex-Nazis. And you couldn't talk about the Nazi Holocaust because then you were accused of undermining the U.S.-West German alliance and playing into the hands of the communists. Because it did happen that, you know, communists didn't like Nazis for good reasons. You know, Hitler killed 30 million, about 20 to 30 million Russians. The war was very brutal on the Eastern Front, very different than what it was on the Western Front. And, you know, Nazis didn't like, you know, the communists didn't like Nazis, and they didn't like the West German government because it was staffed with lots of ex-Nazis, mostly ex-Nazis. And also, and there's no question they played that card, the communists, the Soviet government and the communists, that the United States has entered into alliance with Nazis. And so when they played that card, they talked about the Nazi Holocaust, the extermination of the Jews. And because the communists talked about it, those who wanted to distance themselves from the communists and show their loyal Americans, they didn't talk about it. And there was no discussion at all of the Nazi Holocaust in American life. There are many examples I can give later if people want me to give. I can, you know, provide lots of documentary evidence on that score. Just as a matter of record, and it's an interesting point, before June 1967, in the whole English language, there were only two scholarly studies in the Nazi Holocaust, just two. There was a fellow, Gerald Reitlinger, wrote a book on the Nazi SS, and there was Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews. That was the beginning, and that was the end. When you look at Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem, and you look in her bibliography at the end, she writes Eichmann in Jerusalem around 1963, she can only find two works in the English language. The conservative estimate now is that there are 10,000 studies in the Nazi Holocaust. Things have changed rather dramatically for political reasons, I think, more than any other. It didn't figure at all in American life. The Nazi Holocaust, as I said, I can give lots of illustrations, but I won't belabor that point right now. And it's also interesting to point out that Israel didn't figure at all, I won't say at all, in American Jewish life, but it certainly was at the very bottom of the priorities. If you opened up mainstream Jewish magazines from back then, representing mainstream establishment opinion, like the Commentary magazine, Commentary sort of like the right end of the political spectrum, and Dissent magazine is on the left end of the mainstream spectrum. Woody Allen had that joke, which some of you may know, that if Dissent magazine, which is on the left end, ever merged with Commentary magazine, which is the right end, you'd get dysentery. Which was clever, you know. If you look in Commentary magazine, they used to have on their front cover around the list of all the articles in the magazine, a kind of index in the table of content, the front cover. And usually it was like article number 11 or 12, all the way at the bottom. There'd be something like Israeli kibbutz, you know, and that was it. You know, it was they kept the distance from Israel. American Jews, again for political reasons, there was always the fear of the dual loyalty charge, that who are you, you know, who is your first loyalty to, Israel, the United States? This is before Israel was a main ally of the U.S., so there was a fear of the dual loyalty charge, and there was also a fear of being associated with Israel, which at that time had a profile as a leftist country. You know, these are mostly, people like Ben-Gurion are mostly, they're immigrants from Eastern Europe, have a deep affinity with the leftist, even communist movements of the time. They wanted to be part of the Third International. They were rejected. That's the Leninist International. They joined the Socialist International. They wanted to. They saw themselves. You know, Ben-Gurion admired Lenin, and in general, they were people of the left. And then they had the kibbutzim, and they had this austere lifestyle, and so on and so forth. which was not only alien to American Jewry, but also a source of fear. And so they kept Israel at arm's length as well. It's one of the paradoxes which always, at least it strikes me as a paradox, that not only, as I said, was Nazi Holocaust not a part of American Jewish life, but neither was Israel. The only two people I could find, I went through the record fairly carefully, the only two people I could find who had any public identification with Israel in the early 1950s, the only two I could find were Noam Chomsky and Hannah Arendt. And Noam Chomsky and Hannah Arendt became the main enemies of the Jewish establishment after 1967. But they were the only ones who had a public identification with Israel. You go back, I read all the memoirs of what were called the New York intellectuals, mostly Jewish intellectuals who were very articulate and involved in political life. Editor of Commentary magazine, this fellow named Norman Podhoretz. Editor of Dissent magazine, Irving Howe. Even take the person I'm currently writing on, Alan Dershowitz. If you look in his memoir, he says, I never talked to him. He grew up in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood, Borough Park in Brooklyn, actually 8 blocks away from where I live. He was on 48th Street and 16th Avenue. I was on 40th Street and 16th Avenue. It's an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. He said, growing up, we never talked about the Holocaust. Never. It was just never a subject. And he talks about his first involvement with Israel comes in 1967. He's pretty straightforward about that. And that's a typical profile. That's why I think it's a mistake. I'll make the political point now. I think it's a mistake for people to think that American Jewish loyalties of the Jewish establishment with Israel has much to do with ethnic loyalties. And I think that's true at all.